So let me present myself very briefly again. I'm Philippe Massard. My role at Real Dolmen is the Solution Manager of ALM. ALM stands for Application Lifecycle Management. And I'm also responsible for Team Foundation Server as a tool. My background is that of a software engineer. I have done several software development projects. I'm a trainer as well, certified. And if you want to follow me on the latest news about Team Foundation Server, Visual Studio, you can follow me on my Twitter account. So what are the objectives of today's presentation? First of all, I'd like you to understand what the role of people, processes, and tools are in software development. Because this presentation is not only about Team Foundation Server as a tool, not only about Agile as a methodology or a process, but it's about a combination of the two, and I want to illustrate how the two make each other stronger. So I'll start with an overview of Team Foundation Server 2010, which is the tool. I'll introduce Agile as movement, as a methodology. And then, which is for me the most crucial part, is I'll try to show you what the value is of a good tool for a good process and why you need a good process if you have a good tool. So these are the objectives of today. So, like I said, I'm going to start very briefly about the processes and tools in all areas that matter in software development as a process. I'm going to talk about Team Foundation Server 2010 itself, the Agile Manifesto, and I will show you how you do an Agile planning effort with Team Foundation Server 2010 and the Agile process templates that come with it. And then I'll go over, some Agile practices with Team Foundation Server, which includes continuous integration, and I'll try to show you some of that as well. I'm sorry. So we only have an hour, and we have two main blocks, so unfortunately, we won't be able to go deep on all areas, but don't hesitate if you have further questions on things I'll show you. Okay, so like I said, for me, when it comes to software development as a process, as a business, there are three main areas that are as critical as each other. So these are really crucial areas in software development, and if you neglect one of these areas, your software development process as a whole could be endangered. First of all, you have the people. I think you and I and every developer knows that people are the essential thing in software development. The quality of people, the fact that people communicate with each other, that people really collaborate as a team, and that IT departments are aligned to the business of an organization. This is also a people question. These are really very, very important aspects of a software development project. It's the core. Of course, it's not only people. It's also processes. And processes go about, well, how do I manage a project? How do I coordinate the activities between the different people and the different roles that are and the different stakeholders in my software development project? I'm talking about developers, I'm talking about analysts, testers, and so on. And these processes should be as lightweight as possible. You don't want an overcomplicated process. You want a lightweight process that is agile, that can handle change, that is based on common patterns and practices. And of course, you want a process that is customizable. There is no one-size-fits-all in software development. Every team, every company has its own requirements. Last but not least is the tools. Now, in my view, the tools allow the people to make the processes alive. Processes without tools are essentially dead. It's paper. So the tools should integrate the processes, yeah, and should allow the people to operate on those processes in a very productive way, without much overhead, without much application switching, and so on. So, and the integration aspect. So today we are talking about Agile, which is more on the process side, and Team Foundation Server, which is more on the tool side. And I show you how these make each other stronger. Okay. So since most of you have a basic knowledge of Team Foundation Server, I'll go quickly over the base of Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio 2010 as a whole. So Team Foundation Server is the central collaboration, ALM collaboration platform in a software development team. Its intention is to make the collaboration between all different roles, not only developers, but also analysts, testers, project managers, the business even, to coordinate those efforts and make sure that everybody is working on the same data, on the same set of artifacts, on the same documents. So Team Foundation Server provides a number of services. You as developers might certainly know, well, of course, there is version control. Everybody knows source saves and version. So configuration management, version control is an essential part of Team Foundation Server. Then you have things like project management and requirements management. These are all the activities related to tracking tasks, tracking projects, tracking tests, and so on. So basically, the coordination of your project. One new aspect is test case management. It's new in Visual Studio 2010, and it's about the integration of manual and semi-automated and even automated test tools right into the core of Team Foundation Server. That's one of the big added values of Team Foundation Server 2010. Another essential part we will encounter later in the presentation is the build automation. So Team Build is a build server that is actually integrated in Team Foundation Server and sits at the core of Team Foundation Server. And then to your far right, you have the reporting aspect. Now, reporting is essential in Team Foundation Server because it gives you visibility into all parts, into all areas of the software development process. You should imagine Team Foundation Server as a large SQL Server database, which is true, actually. This SQL Server database contains all information about bugs, about tasks, about everything that goes around, about versions, about documents, about tests and test results, about builds. Imagine anything that has to do with your software development project, it sits there in the Team Foundation Server database. And it's almost automatically, well, captured by Team Foundation Server as a tool. And the reporting aspect just sits there and has an enormous pool of data it can mine and extract very useful information from. So the reporting gives you very useful insights into all the aspects of your project. Now, previously I was talking about the fact that we would integrate the process in the tool. So how does this integration actually look like? Well, it looks like this. It's the white ring. It's the process template. And the process template will actually mimic the process in things like project management, in things like reporting, and so on. So the process template determines how these aspects of Team Foundation Server behave. Yeah. So every process template comes with its own reports, comes with its own document templates, comes with its own work item types. We'll talk about that later on. So the process template is really what makes Team Foundation Server alive and make Team Foundation Server as an agile tool in this case. And we'll see that there is not only one, but there are different process templates, some for agile, some for Scrum, that behave a bit differently, and according to the size of your team and the methodology you are following, you're going to prefer one process template over another one. Team Lab management, we'll go over that soon. Then we have at the outside, we have the clients. The clients are the actual tools that every stakeholder use to interact with Team Foundation Server. Now, as a developer, we all know Visual Studio 2010, but Visual Studio 2008, 2005, 2003, even VB6 integrate with Team Foundation Server. But this is, of course, only a developer tool. Testers have their new dedicated tool, which is Test Manager. And that's really a tool that has been designed from the ground up in WPF for tester to manage, execute, and follow up test cases, bugs, builds, and so on. And of course, when we talk about other stakeholders, we also talk about project managers, for example, or team leaders, who will typically use Excel or MS Project to manage the project itself. So from within Excel, from within MS Project, they will work with the same task, with the same artifacts that you work with from within your Visual Studio. So there is no fragmentation there. And when I continue, I see that there are different clients in the outer ring. This one is especially also interesting, which is a web access. Web access is a web site that allows interaction with all these aspects on Team Foundation Server. So that's typically used for stakeholders that don't have a Visual Studio or just want to have a quick view on the reporting or on the dashboards of your project. The right part is very interesting as well because it allows you to extend Team Foundation Server and to interact with other tools or your own tools. The API is very simple, very powerful, and allows you to control every aspect of Team Foundation Server. Just as a quick note, the Java and Eclipse community also integrates perfectly in Team Foundation Server, since with Team Explorer everywhere, there is now a tool that allows to integrate those IDs as well in Team Foundation Server, and you have a similar experience than in Visual Studio. So for mixed teams, mixed projects, this is especially interesting. Okay, so we'll get a bit deeper in a few aspects of Team Foundation Server. First of all, the work item tracking. Now, the work items are everything that represent or result in work that need to be acted upon. What do you think of, for example, a user story, or a requirement, a bug, a task, an issue, a risk? Whatever you want to keep track of, you can keep track of it using work items. And that is what work item tracking is about. You have different types of work items, and each type has its own set of fields, its own workflow, and a bug goes through another workflow than a task or a change request or whatever. It has its own validation and logic, and that goes quite far. There is some real intelligence you can build into work item types. And they have their own custom layout that is consistent through the different clients you are using it. For example, if you have a task work item type, it will look exactly the same from your web interface than from your Visual Studio interface. Some common behavior of all work items is also an automatic audit trail, so you have an exact trace of who changed what and when. So for auditing purposes, that's very useful. And work items can be linked to one another. That's very useful, of course, to link a task to a bug or to link a bug to a test or whatever. So they can be linked to give a more meaningful context to them. They can be assigned to person. That's also a constant in all work item types. They can contain attachments, links, and so on. So that's standard behavior to all work items. And you can view and edit them using, like I said, Visual Studio, Excel, Microsoft Project, and TFS Web Access, and even your application if you decide you need something additional or you want to integrate with it. And typically you work with work item queries. The concept of queries, I think, is new to you. You work with named work item queries in order to organize your work items in a logical way. For example, my to-do list contains all the work items, whatever the type, that are assigned to me, and I just call it to-do list. Okay. Now, version control is another very important part in Team Foundation Server. What I want to point out first is it's not based on SourceSafe. It's not a vNext of SourceSafe. It's a real new, built from the ground up version control system that is much more robust, much more stable and scalable than SourceSafe, and support things like atomic check-ins, because, well, you have the transactional system of SQL Server that is lying, that is underlying. It allows you to work in a very transactional way, which wasn't possible, by the way, with Visual Sourcing. It contains powerful branching and merging possibilities. In Visual Studio 2010, this has been extended with very nice features like branch hierarchy visualization, where you can visualize the relationships between your branches, and change set tracking. And change set tracking is also a very nice feature that allows you to see which changes have actually been merged in which branches. You know, in a version control system, you have a branching and merging strategy. I think Peter talked about this a few weeks ago. Well, if you want to know which change currently resides in which branch and which branch it has already or hasn't already been merged, then you have this tool of change set visualization, which allows you to do that very, very easy. And it has some really nice innovative functions like shelving, and we'll encounter that a bit later as well. Check-in policies. I think you're familiar with check-in policies. I should have asked who followed the presentation of Peter a few weeks ago, then I would have skipped this slide altogether, but check-in policies allow you to have some, well, formal policies that must be met before code can actually be checked in. For example, I require that every developer that checks in code associates his check-in with a work item, for example, a bug or a task. Would make sense for traceability and so on. That's one example of a check-in policy. So that's also the integration with the work item tracking system. You can make relations between your work items and the code you changed to actually implement or get this work item done. And that is something that is very, you don't need to switch between tools to do this. You don't need to type a lot or have a big administrative overhead. No, you just click the work item when you check in. It's automatically associated, and this information is very easily persisted. And it is crucial information, by the way. Okay. Another aspect of Team Foundation Server is the dashboards, the reporting functionality. I talked about the reporting engine. It's completely based on Microsoft BI tools, so analysis services, loops, SQL Server reporting services, and it provides you with the visibility and transparency you need as any stakeholder or as a project manager would typically need. So this is an example of a dashboard, and there are several dashboards that highlight one specific aspect of your project, like the quality, like the test state, like whatever. So these, of course, again, are specific to the process template you actually use. I talked about a build server. I think build automation is probably a concept you're familiar with, but the new build automation, the new build server in Team Foundation Server 2010 is now completely based on Workflow Foundation 4, which makes it very, very easy to maintain and to extend, because you're basically just extending it by adding activities which are based on .NET code. So forget the MS build syntax and extending MS build. It wasn't that transparent. Now that it's based on Workflow Foundation, not only have you a clear view on the actual workflow that is being followed during a build, you also have a very easy extension and maintenance. Different build types. Of course, you can build on a manual request, scheduled builds, not nightly builds typically. And there are two new build types, which is, well, no, the only new one is the gated check-ins, but there are two build types that are very interesting when it comes to agile programming, which is continuous integration build and the gated check-in build. I'll talk about the gated check-in build, and I'll try to show it as well. So there's the build server comes with its own management possibilities for build quality, build retention. So really the maintenance you have on this build server is very, very low, because you don't have to clean up yourself and so on. So it's very flexible. And again, it's integrated. It's part of the foundation server. It sits there next to the work item tracking and to the version control. And this unique position makes that the build server is actually, well, very well placed to give you information which would otherwise be difficult or manual to reassemble. For example, after your build, you need release notes. That's a typical thing. Well, because the build server is integrated inside the Team Foundation server, these release notes are provided automatically, because the build server knows which changes in version control happens, knows for which reason they were made, to solve a bug, to implement a task or whatever, and can provide this information out of the box as part of the release notes of the build. So that's really the added value you get when you talk about an integration, an integrated toolset. It's very flexible as well. That's also something new in Visual Studio 2010. There is now a concept of controllers and agents, and it allows you to be very flexible in the configuration of your build agents. You can dedicate some agents to some specific tasks. You can, it's much more flexible than it used to be. I think we don't have time to go deeper in this, but it's truly a nice thing compared to the previous version. And of course, a build in itself doesn't have much value when it's only a build. You are going to want to do build certification tests. You're going to deploy your application as part of the build. Again, this is easily configurable or extensible using Workflow Foundation or using the standard build templates that are there. Testing, again, you have fully integrated test tools, and the advantage is, again, test tools are in the middle of the Team Foundation server, so communication between testers and developers isn't that much of a problem anymore, because information is collected automatically when the testers execute their tests, and it's passed on to the developers to allow them to fix eventual bugs, for example. So again, here, integration. They have their own test tools, new test tools, that are specific to Visual Studio 2010, and which integrated the role of the manual tester very, very nicely in the complete application lifecycle. Lab management, I'm going to go very quickly over this, but these are wonderful tools. I think there will be one time in 10 years that everybody will use lab management and will wonder how we could manage it without that. I mean, lab management allows you to set up testing environments very, very easily. You know how difficult it can be to request or set up a new environment. It can help you a lot during testing, because you can make snapshots of failure environments. You can go do exploratory testing. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but basically you start with a good working environment and you try to break it and you explore your application and hunt for bugs. Well, okay, after half an hour of exploratory testing, usually your environment could be a bit corrupt or could have problems with it. Well, if you have a snapshot and you can go back to the initial state, then there is no problem at all, obviously. So the value of the combination of testing, deploying, and virtualization is really huge. So this can, for example, also be integrated with your build process. I build an application. My build server builds the application, obviously. It restores a testing environment to a known empty state. It deploys the application into the environment. It takes a snapshot. Well, that's nice, because then I have a snapshot of every version I ever deployed in a working environment. I run tests that can be quite destructive. And I just restore the snapshot I took in the previous step, and that's it. So that's very easy to configure as part of the build. Again, I think that's the word I said the most during the last 30 minutes, is integrated. I often hear people compare version control of Team Foundation Server to other tools, to Subversion, to Perforce, whatever. I think all those tools are very nice tools, but the real power from Team Foundation Server comes from the integration, that it sits between all the other things, and forget the silo thinking. I need an application for this, I need an application for that, I need an application for that, and they're all open source and everybody is happy until you have to spend enormous amounts of time to make them talk together and to integrate them with another. So you put less effort in capturing useful data. Like I said, during your daily activities, all this data, all these things you do are automatically captured and it's transformed in very useful information and reports just as well. So forget silos. Okay, so that was the part of Team Foundation Server itself. Now, let's go to Agile. What is Agile? Well, I think it was in 2001 that a number of developers came together and, well, they wanted to think about a more lightweight way of developing software. Until then, the processes would have been very heavy, typically waterfall, and sometimes even the process was like becoming a goal in itself. And they were saying, that's not right, because the goal is the application we're making, is the goal is the added value we are making for the business that requested the application. The goal is not the process itself. So they wanted something more lightweight, and they came up with the Agile Manifesto, which contains four statements, and statements that are really crucial. They said, okay, for us, individuals and their interactions are more important than processes and tools. So regular interaction with all stakeholders is crucial. And working software is also more important than comprehensive documentation, unless you are in a very specific environment that needs heavy validation. Well, the documentation isn't a goal in itself, and the only goal is to have working software and to add value to the customer that requested it. And the collaboration with this customer is much more important than the contract negotiation. I mean, don't try to carve everything in stone. No, collaborate and allow change to be introduced into the process instead of wanting to follow a long-term plan, you see? Because change is inevitable. Change will be everywhere, not only the environment of the customer, companies, merge, legislation changes. This is already a big change. But also, customers realize things during the build phase. When you are building things and you are showing things and you are sharing what you have built with your customer, well, priorities could change, views could change. And that is really something that should be integrated in a process and shouldn't be the enemy of the process like it used to be. So what is Agile? It's more of a terminology question this slide. Okay, we have the Agile movement. We have some Agile methodologies and we have some best practices that are typically, well, linked to one or other best practices and other methodologies. So any process can be made Agile. Agile isn't one process or one methodology. But you see, you know, probably all three of them, feature-driven development, Scrum, and XP. So when you look at the best practices, you see some things like here, CI, continuous integration, test-driven development, concepts like a product backlog, a sprint backlog, and these are all practices that you will typically need tools for to integrate and to productively work with. And we'll go a bit deeper into continuous integration a bit later. So just as a recap, basically, when you compare Agile to other methods, in Agile methodologies, you have a much shorter iteration. Well, other processes have some sort of iteration, often called milestones, but that's more in months than in weeks, like it is with an Agile methodology. The aim is also that after every iteration, you deliver a fully completed, tested application. I mean, the functionality you have added during your iteration or during your sprint, like it's called in Scrum, well, it should be really production ready. That's a very, very important thing in Scrum. And Agile doesn't try to be predictive like some other methodologies, will try to have a very, very long time planning. And okay, they try to manage change, but change is still the enemy. Nobody wants to change. While in Agile, well, the core of Agile is it will change. So let's embrace that change. Let's include it into our process. And you really see that in an Agile methodology like Scrum, this could be Scrum, you have different iterations that look alike, that have a planning phase, that have a build phase, and that have a sort of retrospective phase where you actually share the information in the output with the customer, allow the customer to change his mind and really look back at how the previous sprint went, what the problems were, and so on and so on. So this learn phase here is really crucial and it's really built in the Agile methodologies. So we'll have a look now at Scrum. Until now I've talked about Agile, but Scrum is a very formal Agile methodology. And I'll go through the typical workflow, typical process of a Scrum project. So this slide show you the big circle here is the sprints. Sprints, also known iterations, in Scrum terminology, it's a sprint. It's something between 1 and 4 weeks long, not longer than that. The result of the sprint is what you call a shippable increment. So it must be done. It must be tested. It must be complete. It must be production ready. At the beginning of every sprint, you have a sprint planning phase where you sit together with the product owner. We didn't talk about him yet, but that's the person from the business who is really representing the business and who knows which value he wants to add to the application. So you sit together with this person and you go over his list of product backlog items, yeah, PBIs, also called user stories in some cases. So this product owner maintains this list of prioritized user stories of product backlog items. You go over it together with him during the planning phase. You decide which of these items you will actually implement, and then during the sprint, it's actually being implemented. And during the sprint, of course, change, well, is also you want to avoid too much change during the sprint, but in the sprint planning phase, the product owner is the one who determines what will be done and in what the priority is of his product backlog. One little loop here we shouldn't forget is the daily Scrum, which is also well known in Scrum, which is a very, very short meeting where every team member very briefly talks about what he did yesterday, what he's going to do today, and which problems he's currently facing. This seems waste of time, but it isn't at all, because it really surfaces problems that are there, and you know, situations where somebody is stuck for 4 or 5 days on a software problem while the neighbor exactly knows what his problem is, those situations can't occur if you have daily Scrum. Okay. So I'm going to go through this process a bit more visually. So you have the product backlog, you have your user stories, they're prioritized, they're also estimated. Now the shape of a user story is really aimed at the value you want to describe. So this is really something that describes a feature that will add business value. The format you typically describe it is as a person, so as a new customer, I must be able to register online, okay, what must he be able to do, so that I can start using the services. Well, okay, that's an obvious one, but it really explains what the value is for the person of the business who will be using this application. So you prioritize them and you estimate them using what you call story points. And story points are an artificial number. It mustn't be a real number of hours or days or whatever. It's just a number that gives an idea or estimates the effort you have to put in the implementation of a single user story. Okay? And new user stories can be added by the product owner at any time. He can change the priority and so on. He is the master of his product backlog. He decides what the priorities are of the application he pays for and he requests. So during this first phase here, the sprint planning, first of all, the team and the product owner are going to sit together and are going to estimate the stories in the product backlog. As far as this hasn't been done, estimations can be done through a game also. I don't know if you know the game. It's called Planning Poker. It's where everybody has a deck of poker cards with numbers on it, and every user story is estimated, and okay, at a certain time you decide to put your card on the table you think corresponds to the efforts you will need to implement that user story. And if you die of 4 and your neighbor has 12, for example, then it perhaps needs a bit of clarification. So it brings to the surface a possible misunderstanding or misinterpretation of the user story and what is required to implement it. So this is a really crucial phase, and it makes sure that everybody is interpreting the user story in the same manner. Okay, so I'm going forward. We are then planning our iteration, our next sprint, and we are deciding which user story we are going to implement. And we know out of historical data, we know how many of these points we used to estimate our user story, how many of these points our team currently is able to do. So that's really called the velocity of the team, is how fast are we developing now? And you'll see that the velocity of a team will increase during the project lifecycle. So you decide which user stories you will implement, and they are subdivided in tasks, so you have a real breakdown. And these tasks are really other work items. We'll see it later what it is. User stories are work items, tasks are work items, and they are estimated in real time, in hours. Okay? So, and then at the end of the sprint planning, the very important thing is that really the team commits to implementing these user stories in the next sprint. So the team was responsible for the estimation, and it is the team that commits to the realization of it. Okay. So if, for example, the user story is a bit too large for this iteration or this sprint, okay, you can remove it. And you can place another one, the next one, in the product backlog space there instead. Okay, and then you commit. And the team commits to the smaller story. Okay, so when the sprint is planned, work can start. And that's the beginning of the sprint that will last for 1 to 4 weeks. That's something up to you, basically. Well, the team starts working on the tasks, starts finishing the tasks, and gradually, you see that there is a graph appearing, which is the burndown chart. And the burndown chart, basically here, that's here at the bottom, shows you the number of remaining hours you need to implement the tasks that are currently unfinished into your iteration backlog. So the ideal line is, of course, that at the end of the sprint, there are 0 remaining hours. But this burndown chart is where you mainly the main graph you will use to follow up this sprint. So that's the process. At the end of the sprint, we're a good team. Of course, we have implemented every user story. And okay, we have now a finished increment of our application that we can potentially put into production and really start working with. And during the sprint review, the team sits together with the product owner and really shows what was done and shows the implementation of the user stories. And according to what you show, okay, the product owner could get different insights and would perhaps want to change some other priorities of some user stories he had in mind. And for the next sprint, everything can be reevaluated, basically. The acceptance criteria are reviewed. I didn't talk about the acceptance criteria, but they're crucial because acceptance criteria are the criteria that must be met in order to consider a user story as done. Because, you know, done is a very relative term. When is something done? Oh, it could mean different things for different developers. Perhaps for one developer, done doesn't mean that it's tested. But for the tester, done means it's tested. You see, so done is something that needs to be very clearly defined, and these are the acceptance criteria, and they are also typically reviewed during the sprint review meeting. So that's the end of our sprint. The stories that we delivered are closed, are removed from the product backlog, and we continue and we go on during the next sprint. And very important thing also is the sprint retrospective, which is done with the team and where you really look back to what problems arose during the sprint, and you really stand still and look back and try to use this information and these useful insights to improve the next sprint. So that's really the improvement process you have in there. Okay, so now I think we've had enough slides now. We have a slide overload. I hope most of you are still awake. But I'll show you how such a planning effort is done using Team Foundation Server. Okay, so this demo is about agile product and sprint planning. So these are two different things. These are two different planning efforts. The first planning effort is a product planning, in which we will have a high-level view of how many user stories we actually can fit into our next iteration. And the sprint planning is the planning of the sprint itself, where we will break down the user stories in tasks, and we will see, this time in real hours, not just in story points, how our team is being, how the resources we have are allocated in the sprint. Just for your information, because that's perhaps useful to know, you see here at the bottom of the slide, you see the products that you can use to do this demo. So you don't need a specific version of Visual Studio 2010. You can do this with a professional, a premium, or the ultimate version. And you can use the Visual Studio Team Foundation Server. Well, you can use, you need Visual Studio Team Foundation Server 2010. What I meant is you can also do this with the basic edition of Team Foundation Server 2010. It's not really an edition. It's more of an installation type where you install TFS without reporting services, without analysis services, but you still have version control and work item tracking, and you still have things like Excel integration. Yes? So that's perhaps good to know. You don't need a full installation of Team Foundation Server in order to do what I'm going to do in this demo. Okay. So I'm going to switch to my VPC. Okay. So what I have here is a VPC which contains Team Foundation Server 2010, which contains Visual Studio 2010, the ultimate edition. And the good news is that this is the standard VPC that Microsoft makes available for download on the site. So you might or might not know it, but there is a set of VPCs, one for Windows Virtual PC, one for Virtual PC 2007, and one for Hyper-V. There is a set of these virtual PCs that you can use to evaluate and to test Team Foundation Server, Visual Studio, and whatever you want. So I'm really using this standard VPC here. I've added some process templates. I'll talk about that later. Okay, so I'm now logged on as a developer. I'm going to start Visual Studio. I hope you can read this because it's perhaps small. Let me know if you cannot read it. But I'm opening Visual Studio, and there is here a window called Team Explorer, and that's basically my window on Team Foundation Server. And the project I'm going to work with here is called Tailspin Toys. What I see here are all the things I talked about, the work items, documents, reports, builds. I can even see a list of my team members here. I can even contact them using unified communication. And of course, I see my source control node. But what I'm going to show now is how this product backlog is actually planned and how we are going to do a breakdown into tasks from the product backlog. Okay. So we'll start at the work items, and we have a number of predefined queries. The scenario here is we have just finished iteration 2, and we are about to plan iteration 3. Okay. So what I have here is an interesting query. It's called product backlog, and it contains all the user stories, because that's the terminology of this process template. It contains all the user stories I need to implement for this project. You see here the typical user story format, the state in which they are, and you see the iteration to which they currently are assigned. These iterations, that's default behavior of the Team Foundation server. Every project has what is called areas and iterations, and iterations here are, well, basically subdivisions into the time. You could place releases in here, but typically here, that's what's by default integrated here. It's iterations 1, 2, and 3, and backlog to indicate that the user story hasn't been assigned to any of the iterations yet. So I see here I have a number of resolved items assigned to iteration 1. I have 3, two are active, and I'm now about to plan iteration 3. So those ones need to be closed, obviously, so I can just go and double click. I can go and close this iteration or resolve it. Okay. Save work item, and I'll do the same for this one. Okay. Now, as you see, I'm working with these work items here from within Visual Studio. Yes? But typically, like I said, we are going to have a concept like team velocity. How many story points have I done in the previous iterations? And that demands for a bit of graphics and a bit of Excel. And, well, luckily, there are some Excel documents and templates that are provided with this specific process template. When I go to the shared documents here, well, by the way, the shared documents are documents that are stored in an underlying SharePoint site. I see here an Excel called product planning. Yes? And this product planning Excel is going to help me in planning and assigning user stories to a specific iteration. So I open this. It's opened in Excel. What you see here is exactly the same list as I saw in Visual Studio. I'm working with the same information, except I'm doing it now from within Excel, which gives me, of course, additional possibilities like this one. And this possibility is a graph that shows me the number of story points that I have implemented with my team during the past iterations. So, in order to work with this list here from Excel, I have in my ribbon, I have a team tab, and I can really go and refresh this, for example. Okay, refresh. I can publish changes I just made, but I'm still working with the same information and not duplicating information here. So I did a refresh, and I have refreshed the resolved state of these three user stories I have completed in iteration 2. And you'll see here in my graphic, it's automatically updated. You see, this shows you the value of Excel as a sort of a dashboard tool. You could use it to easily follow up things, and it's really very flexible, and you use all the power for graphics, pivot tables, and so on that there is within Excel. Okay, so, well, I'm going to plan the next iteration. So this sheet is going to help me. I'm going to, well, there has been a little interruption in my sprint, apparently, but there's no problem there. Let's go for, so this sheet tells me, okay, you have 5 days. My team size is going to be 4 long. Well, let's see, 4, that's 20. I delivered 20 story points. Let's assign some user stories to iteration 3. So what I can do here is I can update. They are in the right order. They are ordered according to the stack rank, which is the priority that my product owner has determined for the user stories. And I just go on and add some of these user stories to my third iteration. Okay, let's see what it gives. Okay, looks nice. Looks nice. Perhaps we have place for just one more. Well, no, a bit too ambitious. Okay, let's put that one back to the backlog, and you see this one, which has a value of 4 story points. It's a bit smaller than the other one. We'll add that one because I have the impression that my team is getting quicker, is getting acquainted with the framework, the toolset, and so on. So I think we can achieve a higher velocity. Okay. So indeed, that's what we see here. And this is basically what this sheet helps you to do. Now, of course, this one is a bit trivial because we have just a few user stories. When you have more user stories or longer or a bigger capacity of story points, then, well, it gets difficult to do by hand. And then it's quite useful to do this with a sheet like this one. You can also add interruptions. So if you say, okay, take a day, let's all go there and go there, the 5th of March. It isn't the 5th of March, just to be sure. But it will also reflect on the capacity and the number of days I have in my iterations. See, so it is just a helper planning tool. And as soon as I've finished this exercise, I've determined the number of user stories I can add to my backlog. I'm going to publish this information, and this information is going to be updated in Team Foundation Server. When I go back here, I refresh, and I see that those user stories have just been added to my backlog. Now, that's step one in my planning phase. The second step is to go and make some tasks that I'm going to individually assign to individual developers in order to actually implement this user story. And therefore, I'm going to use another sheet, which is also provided as part of the MSF for Agile process template. And we have a sheet for everyone. I'm just going to save and close this one. I have a sheet for every one of the iterations, which is going to help me to plan this specific iteration. So every time you have a new iteration, you're typically going to create a new iteration folder, and you're also going to use one of these templates in order to create a new document that will help you to plan it. Okay, so this is going to give me the iteration 3 backlog. So what I'll see here is a list of all the user stories that I have assigned to iteration 3, and I'm going to see the tasks that I need to implement this user story. Let me refresh this. Okay, so you see here there are a number of tasks that already have been added to this, but what I can do very easily is just add a child, like it's called. I'm actually making a relationship between a task work item and a user work item. So let's say that in order to implement this user story, I'm going to have to create another stored procedure. Oh, let's be completely right. Okay, I'm going to say that this task. Okay, and I can really go on. So I can also add work items from within Excel, from within MS Project, from within Visual Studio very easily.
Can also, I interrupt you? There's one question.
Yeah.
Oh. So I think it's a question referring to the Explorer when you were just before in the Team Explorer. Someone saying that I do not see this document map in my Team Explorer window. The document map with those.
You don't see the document map, or is it, or does it have a red cross through it?
Well, the person mentioned I do not see the document map, so let's have him answer to that, and then we'll come.
Perhaps it's the
SharePoint.
Yeah, perhaps the SharePoint bit wasn't installed. When it's not installed, it could be a reason why it's not appearing.
So, Tom, could you please maybe give some more details on your installation, and then we'll try to answer. So
there must be an explanation. Perhaps it's a question of process template as well. because well, some process templates contain more documents out of the box than others. I have, okay. So I'm continuing planning my my sprint here. So I'm creating those tasks. I'm indicating how much the remaining work is, and I'm actually assigning those tasks to one of the developers. Now, I know this is not really like Scrum prescribes it. It's not actually the Scrum process template I'm using either. It's the Agile process template. In the Scrum process template, there is no upfront assignment of these tasks to the individual developers. But okay, this scenario there is, and this sheet will assist you in that scenario. So what I will do now is also assign all those tasks and so on to my third iteration. I can go to my capacity, and the capacity sheet will show me, well, how many hours I have currently, how many task hours I have currently in this iteration. Okay, so what I'm going to have to do now is really define which persons are actually going to participate in my effort here. Also define how many hours these persons are available for this project. Perhaps my dev lead April has only part-time assignment on this project. Abu has 8 hours a day. Doris has also 8 hours a day. Okay. What I have to specify now as well is, okay, for iteration 3, when will it start? When will it end? Okay, let's do that. So 9-3. Okay. I have 5 days. It's a 1 week iteration. And what am I doing here? Oh, sorry. I think we are 2011 already. Okay. So what I see here is, okay, I have 40 hours. I have remaining capacity of 100 hours, so I'm under assigning my team for 40 hours. By the way, if your team is responsible for bug fixing or help desk operations as well during the day, you could limit it to 6 days, for example. And you can really quickly see how well the capacity fits the capacity of your team. And we clearly see here that April is overallocated for 7 hours. So I think we'd better assign some of April's work to somebody else. So let's change this task. Let's give it to Abu. Okay. Well, he's still overallocated for 1 hour. Okay. So this is, again, a sheet that will help me in estimating the capacity of my team, the tasks, and really go more to the task level itself and see how many real hours there are available and so on. So same story here. I can have individual interruptions. I can have global holidays. If I now say, for example, okay, this is an official holiday on the, what did I have? Oops. 5th of March, well, obviously this is going to have an impact on our capacity, you see. Or if Abu is going on a holiday one day as well, I can add this information here. So it's just a planning helper. I won't really use this after I've planned my sprint, but this is a planning helper. Okay, well, the burn down chart, the chart I was talking to you about, is actually also shown in this sheet. So if you want to access this burn down chart through this sheet, you might as well do it also this way. So as soon as I have created, assigned, modified, and so on my work items, I just publish them again. And this information now is accessible to all persons working with Team Foundation Server. So I was talking about a work item query called my tasks. Well, here I'm logged on as Abu. I will look at my tasks. These are really the tasks that have been assigned to me for this next sprint. Okay. And I have a lot of others. Well, like I said, unfortunately, we cannot go very, very deep into this, but there are a lot of other queries, documents, and from a reporting perspective, this process template is exceptionally rich. Okay. So, let me have a look. Just switching back to my presentation, or trying to at least. Okay, so I talked about these process templates and the fact that there are different process templates. Basically, if you want to do Agile or Scrum development, you have the choice nowadays of three typical process templates. First of all, it's the MSF or Agile 5.0, which is the process template that comes out of the box with Team Foundation Server. It has a very nice set of dashboards, portals, documents, reports. So from that perspective, it's very complete. It has, but what it lacks, for example, that is something what the Scrum template has, for example, which is a new Microsoft Scrum 1.0 template, and that is a work item type for the sprint itself. I don't know if you saw that, but there is no work item type called sprint. Yes, in the Scrum process template, not only does it fit more to the real Scrum terminology, it has also a sprint work item type. And the sprint work item type is very useful because it will allow you to keep track of information related to the specific sprint, to the sprint retrospective for the problems. You can eventually you could couple some other information to this sprint work item. So the fact that a sprint is a work item type in itself does add some value, and that's missing from the Agile process template. And you see in the Scrum 1.0 template, which was released a few months ago, you see that it's called differently. The user story in Agile is called the product backlog item, more fitted to the Scrum methodology. So if you are really into the Scrum hardcore methodology and process, perhaps you should have a look at the Microsoft Scrum process template instead of the Agile process template. It does have fewer reports, it doesn't have documents and so on, so it is limited on other areas, but it better fits the Scrum methodology in itself. What is also interesting is that bugs are product backlog items in the Scrum process template. That's an interesting thought, because basically a bug is an unfinished product backlog item. So it does have a high priority to finish the product backlog items that should have been finished in the previous iterations. You see, so that's why in the process template, the Microsoft Scrum process template, they say, okay, bugs are for me also product backlog items. When you go to the work item query called product backlog, you will see the bugs appear in there. And there is another one that's a Scrum for Team System from a manufacturer called Conshango, who also developed process templates for the previous versions of Team Foundation Server. And that one is really for the larger multi-team projects. So where you have different team Scrum teams, and even teams that are not following the same iterations, the same length. So you see that the structure here is really a project is divided in releases, divided in work streams, and these work streams are there to enable different sprint lengths between different groups of teams. Then there is a sprint, and there is team sprint, which is a specific sprint for one specific team. So if you have a team of two or three developers, I think the Conshango process template might be a bit of overkill, and you could better have a look at the Microsoft Scrum process template, for example. There is also a sprint work item type in the Scrum for Team system. This one has the most different types of work items from the three. There's also a very interesting auto rollout engine, which is basically a piece of code running on the server which automatically does sums of anything you want, basically. If you, let's say you have this user story that you have subdivided in tasks, and every one of these tasks has an amount of remaining work. Wouldn't it be interesting to have a sort of roll-up to the user story level and display the number of remaining hours at the user story level as well? So using the hierarchy we created, do a roll-up of a certain number. And I'm being quite vague with of a certain number, and that's because basically you can make it roll up anything you want, and you can even use this roll up engine for your own process template if you need this functionality of rolling up some data. That's something that is missing out of the box from Team Foundation Server, but I know that Microsoft is also working on a own roll up engine that would allow you to do things like that. There's a separate client tool as well with the Scrum for Team System process template, which is called the Scrum Masters Workbench. And it's used for different purposes. It's used for setting up the project. And you saw here, there is quite a difficult structure of interrelated work items. If you have to do this from scratch, well, it could take some time. The Scrum Masters Workbench helps you to predefine the number of sprints, the number of teams according to a certain parameters you introduce. And it also gives you the classical whiteboard with the yellow paper view, which is very familiar for many of the people who did Scrum without tooling. So people who are still liking this interface and like the fact that you can remove one paper from one column and add it to the other. So this swim lane view is something you also get with this Scrum Masters Workbench, and it also works for other process templates as well. Yeah. There are many other tools that do exactly the same, and I think Microsoft is going to have one in the future as well. So, just to have a very quick look at the other process templates, what I have here is not only this Tailspin Toys project, but I have this project that is based on the Microsoft Scrum process template, one that's based on the Django Scrum process template, and one, just like the Tailspin Toys, that is based on the Agile. So if I go and look at the Microsoft Scrum, you see from a document point of view, there isn't much, not to say nothing. From the work items point of view, it's quite limited as well. From the reporting point of view, it's also quite limited, but when you have a look at the work item types, you really see things like a sprint, which I didn't have here. You see, I just had my user story and so on. When you look at the Conchengo process template, you'll encounter even more work item types, amongst them the sprint, and even the sprint retrospective is a separate work item type, you see. From the reporting point of view, there are a lot of reports as well in the Conchengo Scrum process template. You see, in general, every process template can be customized. It's something I didn't mention yet, but you can customize any process template. You can add fields and so on. But it's a bit tricky. Don't try to turn a Conchengo process template into a Microsoft Scrum process template, because if you don't agree with the general concept of these workflows and so on, don't try to change it in a dramatic way, because everything you have from reporting to work item queries will not behave like they should behave. So when you decide to do Scrum with Team Foundation Server, really start by choosing the process template that already fits the best your team size and the requirements and the fact that you are doing hardcore Scrum or not, or look at those aspects. Don't start big to end up small. Try to change the list. I don't know how we are time-wise.
We are 12 minutes past the hour, so.
Okay, so give me 30 seconds.
Finish off?
Well,
I think people will stay a few minutes longer if needed, no problem.
Okay, when I see the number of participants drop dramatically, I'll shut up. Very quickly, we're talking about Agile.
It's not in your screen.
Oh, I'm sorry. Uh, I wanted to go through the some of the other agile practices that you can use and that are really enabled through Visual Studio 2010. And we talk about test driven development, about refactoring and so on. And all those things are really well implemented in Visual Studio as well. So the fact that you can refactor code, test driven development as well, first create the tests and then create the methods from the tests. You know, that's all test driven development practices. We won't get into this very deeply now. What I wanted to show you, if you stay with me for another 5 minutes, is the build automation. Because continuous integration, I'm sure you're familiar with continuous integration, is something that used to be very hard. But it is very useful because you want to encourage people to check in as many times as possible, and you want to integrate all these changes as quickly as possible as well. So the longer you stay working in parallel, the harder it will be to integrate changes with another. So continuous integration is a modus in which your build server operates and with which that every check-in results into a separate build. And this build also includes some build verification tests like execution of unit tests and so on. So continuous integration is of great value and it's very, very easily configurable using the foundation shells.
Okay, and now can I just interrupt you before you go to your build integration then? Continuous build. So there is one person that has the following question, just going to read it out loud. I have several team projects. So can I share human resource planning like holidays, illness, and so forth when planning the iterations of the different projects? So it's really sharing that information between the projects.
Well, that brings us to a more fundamental question is, for which type of project will you create a new Team Foundation server project? Because you could have several projects into one Team Foundation server project. From a version control perspective, it's easily manageable. And if you have this need to manage this team as one whole, it's perhaps even the better strategy to put all these projects into one Team Foundation server project. You see, if you want to do resource management over different projects, it's always a hard thing. I know nowadays, for example, there is an integration with project server, but then you end up with MS project and that's perhaps not as agile as you would be. So I'm not sure if it's an agile project this person is talking about.
Might be in this case.
Perhaps it's useful to have these projects within one Team Explorer project. And work with it that way.
Okay, thank you. But there's another question.
Yeah.
Now that we've got started. What version of Microsoft Office do you need to use DFS 2010?
Office 2007 or 2010. So there's no support for the earlier version.
The earlier. Okay, perfect.
But there is quite a difference between the implementation of the integration with Excel compared to 2008.
DFS
2008.
Okay, I see.
And Visual Studio 2008. And that is the, you have much more flexibility. For example, the value of Excel really speaks for itself when you start adding columns, when you start adding conditional formatting to your columns. And then you can have calculated columns and so on. And those columns used to, well, corrupt everything in the previous version, but are very well managed in the current version. So you can really go much further into with your dashboards than you used to be with TFS 2008. So that's one big reason. If you do much of the Excel integration, do have a look at TFS 2010 because it's much less fragile. Okay, so continuous integration. I'm going to close some windows here. I created a small .NET project here. I'm going to open source control. I have my classical main dev branching. I have a Windows application. And I'm going to open this solution. Okay? So my solution here contains a test project, contains a unit test. I'll show you the unit test. Don't laugh. It's just for demo purposes. It's a very small unit test. And what I'm going to do now is just create a continuous integration build, and I'll show you how easy it is. So I go to my build node in my Team Explorer window. I right-click, I say New Build Definition, and I will call this Windows Form Application Continuous Integration. I specify the trigger. The trigger is, when does this build actually have to build? Is it a manual thing? Do I choose it myself? Or is it a continuous thing that happens each time somebody checks in? By the way, if you have a very large team, well, if every time you check in, a build is fired and build verification tests are run, it might just be that your build server isn't able to cope with the load. And in general, you want to keep the moment, the time between the moment you checked in and the moment that the build actually fires, you want to keep this as short as possible. Because the values of continuous integration comes from the relationship between your check-in and the fact that you broke something. And the sooner you know you break something, the easier it will be for you, because you're still working in your head, you're still working on that code. If you have to go back to that code 3 hours later, it will already be a bit more difficult to see what actually broke the build. So there is a system for this, it's rolling builds. So then basically you say, as long as my build server is building, do accumulated check-ins, and okay, when you're finished building, start a new build with all these check-ins that have been accumulated in the meantime. So you don't have a one-one relationship anymore between a check-in operation and a build, but okay, you do have a quick response on whether you broke something during your check-in. By the way, using this new team build type, team build topology possibilities, what I mean by this is that you can have different build agents and controllers. You could dedicate one specific build agent to continuous integration builds, for example, and just reserve it for that type of build. That's some flexibility you can have with TFS 2010. So I continue. I'm going to specify my workspace. My workspace actually will determine which source code will be pulled to the build server when it starts the build. So I'm just going to include my dev branch. Okay, because that one contains all the code. I'm going to specify a drop folder. That's the folder where my build output will be placed. And here, in this process tab, I can very easily say, for example, that I want some tests to be run automatically. So here, what I can say is, okay, I want all tests that can be found in assemblies fitting this name specification, I want these tests to be executed automatically. Or we could go further, you could say, okay, I have some categories on my test, and I only want to execute tests that have a CI category, or tests with a certain priority. So you can really, this is UI, I'm not editing XML code here, I'm just specifying it in the UI. What I can also say is, fail the build when the test fails. Okay, perfect. Makes sense to me. So here I can go much further and really easily configure some crucial elements of my build. Retention policy determines how long I want to keep builds and when they can be deleted. This will save me some cleanup time. Okay, that's all there is to creating a continuous integration build. I'm going to queue this build. Okay. And you see, this is all perfectly integrated. I see my build explorer, I have a queue of builds, I can double click my build, I can see the build progress. So, let's see, normally this shouldn't take too long. Okay, my build succeeded, one test was run, you see, view the test result. Oh, why is that unable? Okay, small glitch. I see my test results, I see, okay, this test passed, and so on. So I have immediate feedback on what it did and how it did it. Okay, now, let's break the build. And breaking the build in an agile team is a cardinal sin, so this is just for demo purposes.
Okay, so well, we are doing that. There's some more questions.
Yeah.
Maybe off topic, Tom mentions that. Can I increment assembly version on every build? Or is there another best practice for this?
No, there is a way to increment very easy assembly versions on every build. That's a good practice.
That's it.
Yeah. So, okay, let's break the build. Let's say that my class 1, which is currently quite complex, I will make it even more complex by adding a constructor. And just I will throw a new, well, that's my bug for. Just to be clear, that's my bug. Okay, let's check in this change, and we'll see that. Oh.
Yes. And then. Too much.
Okay, I'm checking in. Normally, what I should do, of course, before I check in, is get the latest version and do a sort of integration on my local system before I actually push everything to the build server. But okay, that's not something that is always done. So I've checked in and I see that a build, this one, has been fired. And I will see my build fail because I threw an exception and my test will fail on this assert statement. So again, here, that's a very, very nice feature. Well, okay. It's already filled before I could show it. You know, the bars here, the small bars, give you an idea of how long the previous build took. So you have a sort of history there. And I see my test run failed. Which test failed? Okay, test method 1 failed. Again, here I can double click, and I had a system application exception. That's my bug. Okay. Now, like I said, this is the cardinal thing. So I should avoid breaking the build altogether. And in large team, what we sometimes see is that the build is just always broken. So how could you avoid breaking the build? Well, that's where the new build type comes in, and that's called gated check-ins. So let me first fix this build. That's called a quick fix. I'm going to check in those changes. Okay. What I'm going to do now is change my build definition, yeah, and I'm going to make a gated check-in build. I'll explain exactly what it is. A gated check-in build is a build that actually builds and validates the code you are about to check in before you actually check it in. In a continuous integration build, I did check in the build. My version went into the central source repository and was available to anyone who did get the latest version. So this was already too late because I broke the build. In a gated check-in, I want this validation to happen before it's actually checked in. And it's very easy as well. I edit the build definition, I go to trigger, and I just choose gated check-in. So how does this behave? Well, let me reintroduce my second bug. Oops. Well, whatever. I've introduced a second. I'm going to check this one in. Okay, what's going to happen? This is where I get this dialog box, a gated check-in dialog box. Now, what happens beneath below the covers is my changes to class 1 have been shelved. I hope you know what a shell set is, but the shell set is a storage space on the server that lives next to the version control system, and it is more or less isolated and private to you. So what this check-in system, what this build system did is, okay, it created the shell set, and it said, okay, what I need to do now is first create a build using the information on this shell set, and only when this build succeeds, I will check in the information that you put on this shell set. And I have different options here. I can say, preserve my pending changes locally, Well, basically what you're saying is, you know, when you create a shell set, you have the option of reverting your local workspace to the previous version. But, well, that's I think, out of scope of this talk. But here, basically what I'm saying, keep this class one as a pending check-in in my current workspace. Okay. I'm going to build, and I'm going to have a build error because I put it there myself. So what happens now? First of all, I can continue working. There's no problem. I can continue editing, working, and so on. And this build is really working for me and validating my code that it put on the shell set. And you see that this class one is still as a pending check-in in my workspace. Okay. Now, how will you get notified that there is an actual result of my build? Because now I know that my build will fire now because the build queue was empty, but there might as well be 10 builds in front of it, and my build could only be treated in half an hour. Well, there is this utility here, which is a Team Foundation build notification tool. This build notification tool is already something that exists for longer than today. It existed in the past. But this build notification has got a new role in the whole process of the data check-ins. So let's have a look how far my build is. Okay, my build actually failed. Well, that was expected, of course. And you see check-in rejected. So there is no check-in that happened. Okay? So, well, I'm not really notified now because I looked for it myself, but if I wait a few seconds more, I will get a notification from my build notification tool indicating me that the check-in was rejected. So basically what I could do now is just, well, get the latest version and have a look at why my build was failing. Yeah. Okay, but why is the build notification? It takes a bit of time, this build notification tool. Anyhow, it's not that critical either. I mean, if the notification comes 1 minute or 2 minutes later, it's not really a problem. Okay, but we will get the build notification eventually, but we'll just ignore it. So let's see how this now behaves when I actually succeed in building. So I'm going to remove my bug again. I'm going to check in this information. Okay. I'm going to have the same message. You need to build your changes. It created a new shell set for me. I say build the changes. And now we're going to have a build that succeeds. But ultimately, you want this class 1.cs to be checked in because that was the whole purpose. Okay. You see here the notification appearing. This is the first notification, get the check-in rejected. What I can do now is say, okay, I want to ignore this, or I can say I want to unshelve the changes I have placed previously on the shelf. This is something I would do when I discarded my changes in my local workspace. Since I didn't discard the changes in my local workspace, they're still there, I'm going to ignore this. In the meantime, we see that our second gated check-in build has succeeded, but there is still this pending change into my local workspace. So when is this going to happen? Well, we'll have to wait a bit for our build notification tool again, because what is going to happen now is I'm going to what Microsoft calls reconcile my local workspace. So what the system will do during reconciliation is have a look at the pending changes I have in my workspace, compare it to the pending changes I actually checked in, well, was actually checked in by the data check-in build, and discard those pending changes in my local workspace to reflect the fact that it was actually checked in from the change set, from the shell set. So it sounds a bit complicated. When I double click here, I see check-in committed. So this change here is already committed to the source control system, although it isn't reflected yet in my local workspace. It's only when I do a reconciliation that it will be reflected. Well, if you are not patient enough to wait for the Team Foundation, the build notification, you can click to the reconcile workspace here just as well. I say reconcile workspace. It says, okay, I detected this change, and this is a change I already committed from the shell set after I did this gated checking build. I say reconcile, and okay, now is the situation I was expecting. That is that my change is actually checked in and doesn't appear anymore as a pending change in my local workspace. So that's some, well, it's more or less a guarantee that your build won't be broken. It's quite a complicated method, so it's only, okay, here it is, my gated check-in, you know, you see I can reconcile it from here. I already reconciled it, so I don't have to do it here. This gated check-in is powerful, but you have to know what happens and have a clear view, because it can get a bit complex with those shell sets and so on. Like I said, I can also continue working while this gated check-in build is running, and I can change things locally, and in the end, it doesn't get that transparent anymore. So this is one of the examples of an agile practice that you can really easily implement using a toolset like Team Foundation Server.
You're not sharing slides?
No, that's right. I'm.
I think we.
Yes.
We'll wrap up. Very enthusiastic. And
I know.
Almost everyone stayed online, so.
That's great. Thank you very much.
That is. It is interesting, but I think we need to.
I'm going to close because this was my conclusion anyway.
I'm sorry. I would like.
No. You're right. No, the conclusion is this: software development, like we talked, it's about people, processes, and tools. We talked about a specific process, agile processes, methodology, and how the tool can enable this methodology. In the planning phase, in the continuous integration, in some practices like test-driven development, and that's really the conclusion. Team Foundation Server 2010 enables these agile methodologies and practices, and you would miss upon a huge increase in visibility and productivity if you wouldn't use the correct tool set for an agile methodology. I have some resources here you'll find on the slide deck I'm going to upload right away. So here are some links to the VPC, the same ones I used for the demo. The closest template is available here, just click. And if you want to know more about Agile Manifesto and how it all started, there is a link as well. And for further information, I refer to additional questions.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. So if you want to stay online for a few minutes, Philip is going to upload the handouts today. Otherwise, you can expect to find them for download on the channel online page that we are going to set up with this video, so that you have, again, the opportunity to view the demos more at your own pace. Again, thanks for staying online with us so long.
And thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And we'll join you next time.